early in the 1970s, in the field of art history, a number of women said, let's look at art history and let's try to recover our traditions. Let's try to look and see if some things have been buried or become obscure. Let's look at the way the history of art has been recorded. Let's acknowledge the fact that it's been recorded by men. And so tonight, I would like to talk about Judith Lester. And Judith Lester is one of these women who has been discovered through recent scholarship. And she turns out to be a very interesting woman, and she has some unique women's perspectives on some traditional subjects. Tomorrow I'll talk about another woman, Artemisia Gentileschi, and her treatment of the theme of Susanna and the Elders from a very unique, very different point of view from the hundreds and hundreds of treatments of that subject in the 14th through the 18th centuries. Judy Lester, I call her Judy because I feel very close to her. I don't know if she would approve of that. But Judy Lester was written about in her own day as a very promising star. That's what that word Lester means in Dutch. It's a lodestar, a very special kind of star. And writers in her own time, I suppose trying to make a pun, said she's a rising star in the art world, or she's a real star. We use that same kind of phrase today. She was basically unheard of after her death in 1660. In 1927, a woman wrote a thesis on Judy Lester and uncovered most of her work. But again, Judy Lester remained in obscurity. And it was in 1975 that another paper was presented on this woman, and suddenly the world started to realize that this was a very special person. I mentioned last week a very important meeting at the College Art in America conference in New York in 1978, when the Caucus for Women in Art met with a series of commission papers. People had been assigned different topics to look into the treatment of the image of women or the history of women or to look at women painters who had disappeared. And this paper on Judy Lester was one of those presentations at that conference. This is a self-portrait of Judy, or Judith, at the age of 21. Her father was a brewer. The presence of women in art usually is the result of having a father who's in art, a father who got around some of the restrictions about women studying the human figure or women coming into apprenticeship situations. There are a few women artists who had artist fathers. But in this case, Judy Lester had a businessman, manufacturing father who was a brewer. But he recognized that she had some talent at the age of 15, I believe. And he got her together with other genre painters, that is, painters of ordinary life in Holland. And she was educated. And by the age of 24, she was admitted into the Guild of St. Luke. St. Luke is the patron saint of painters. And to be accepted into the guild is a mark of real distinction. So by the age of 24, she was held in high regard by her fellow countrymen. And this is a self-portrait at the age of 21. I don't know how familiar you are with 17th century painting, but a lot of her work was confused with that of Frans Hals. And she must have been an intimate of Frans Hals and would have known him very much. And for a long time, people thought this possibly was a Frans Hals painting because some of the vigor in the way it's painted is very much like Hals. But we can also assume that she knew Rembrandt and that possibly she Well, she did live in the same town with Rembrandt, so obviously she would have known him. And possibly there would have been a relationship there. Her point of view, like all of the Dutch painters in the 17th century, is the point of view of realism. Painting what one sees. And this is the dominant form of art after the Reformation, after the High Renaissance. I wish we had this last night before Jeff left, this flute player. This too was painted at a very early age, I think before, in her early 20s. And I have a detail of this which is quite startling. I just was noticing, just a little art talk here, but I was noticing the wonderful way that these lines cascade around this central point. The angle of this down here in the bottom part of the painting moves through the arm, and then you get the angle of the flute, and then you get the angle of the bow and the violin and the other instrument over on the side, so you get sort of a fan-like shape that revolves around this point, and there's a lot of tension between that point and the direction that the young flute player is looking. Let's see, I'm a painter, and I look at those kinds of things, the way things are put together. I try to account for the kinds of thinking that go into the shadow on the left or the play of shadows on the bottom underneath the violin. They all contribute to the kind of dynamism of the image. I don't know what these artists in the past would think of if they could walk into our lecture halls today and see the way we blow up these little bits and pieces to make details. That flute looks very much like the flute that Jeff played in the concert last night, the Baroque flute. Looks identical. But I want to try to show how Judy Lester is different from her contemporaries. And I will try to do the same thing tomorrow, to show how these are very strong women who are looking at things from a uniquely feminine perspective. And Judy Lester is amazing and marvelous and wonderful because of the way she treats a certain subject. And the main painting I want to talk about today is a painting called The Proposition. And it's a painting of a man trying to seduce this woman. The subject of prostitution, of brothels, of bawdy houses, of merrymaking, of drinking and eating and lovemaking. This is a very strong subject in the 17th century. And there are dozens and dozens of paintings which focus on this activity. And we could ask, is this a reaction against Calvinism? Or is there some way that Calvinism stimulates this kind of activity? Brothel houses, all of that kind of immoral activity certainly is forbidden fruit. And I'm not capable of really, I'm not a student of Calvinism. I don't know if strong prohibitions against that kind of activity stimulate that kind of activity. At any rate, it's all forbidden fruit, and forbidden fruit is attractive. And humankind is drawn towards those kinds of activities that are denounced. The society in Holland in the 17th century is a society that's the result of the Reformation. There are ways in which Calvinism stimulates a very materialistic point of view about life. The Dutch lifestyle is a lifestyle of getting and spending. This is a very powerful economic entity. It's a naval power. They have business all over the world. They're interested in things, in rich things and rich stuffs. And perhaps they're interested in the kind of life that's represented by these kinds of paintings. This painting is called The Procurus, and the painter's name is Gerard Honthorst. And this was painted in 1625, a little bit before our Judy Lester paints her version of this same kind of scene. All of these painters learned about light. And again, it goes back to an Italian painter named Caravaggio, who started to illuminate certain important parts of his paintings with light. Usually in Caravaggio's paintings, the light came from outside of the painting itself. But a lot of the followers of Caravaggio had to have some explanation for the light. So here we have this candle that peeks out from inside of the painting. Rembrandt also is of the school of Caravaggio, this school of realism, which depended on a kind of Hollywood lighting, very dramatic lighting for its impact. But Rembrandt molds from a kind of mechanical light source in the painting to a light that comes from within the actors. When Christ at Emmaus in Rembrandt's painting is presented, the light comes from within Christ. It's a spiritual kind of light. This is a more naturalistic, more mechanical, more photographic kind of light. But one gets a sense when you look at 17th century Dutch painting that every woman is a wench. She wears this low-cut dress, and I read that that was an indicator that the woman is unmarried, and that when the woman was married, she wore a high neck dress. But at any rate, you get the feeling that all women are wenches, and they are all looking for customers, and they carry these musical instruments, the lute, and the lute is used to play seductive music. And so this man holds out his hand. He holds money in his hand. Money is a vehicle for exchange. Money is an indicator of ill-matched lovers. Feeble old men can buy a woman for money, but it's an unnatural kind of relationship. A very strong theme in 17th century painting is the prodigal son theme. And you find it over and over again in countless paintings. And the biblical texts for the prodigal son are in Luke 15, verse 31, talks about how he wastes his life among the harlots. Verses 30 and 31 are talking about his relationship with women, and becomes a favorite theme for 17th century painters. But I don't know that they're necessarily trying to illustrate the Bible. It simply, again, becomes an occasion to celebrate this forbidden fruit. This is a painter named Ter Borch. And the subject matter is, the gallant soldier. And this gallant soldier, he thinks he's a gallant soldier. And he sits there in the house of this very elegant woman. He's a little bit overweight. His hair is unruly. His legs are apart. He holds in his hand money. It's a very subtle kind of painting because she looks like a very fine woman. But there's all this evidence of the fact that this is probably a brothel. There's fruit on the table and flowers, and she holds a glass of wine and a pitcher of wine, and she's pouring drink. And obviously, the gallant soldier, has had too much to drink, and he's tottering in his chair. Well, I think the painting, basically, I don't think there's a great deal of sympathy for the woman. Obviously, she's a participant in this event. There's a kind of mutual attraction here. Maybe he's seducing her, but she's also seducing him. And it seems to be taking place in a rather elegant house. It's an aristocratic woman in an aristocratic setting, but even aristocratic people are engaged in this kind of activity. But I don't think there's any way that we have any kind of strong feeling towards the woman. Rather, she's just as much, in a sense, she's just as gross as the man is. This is the gallant soldier detail of his face with his wild hair, his glazed eyes. In many ways, he's a repulsive kind of person, an unattractive person. But the money equalizes the relationship between the two. And you might call it an ill-matched relationship, but the money makes it legitimate. In the prodigal son theme, the woman is often stealing the money from the man. She kisses or embraces the man, but she picks his pockets. In the prodigal son stories, the woman often engages the prodigal son in a card game, but she's cheating at cards. So I think one of the themes in the prodigal son is that woman degrades man, and the prodigal son is not guilty of anything. I mean, it's not his fault that he ran into these sleazy women who are out to get him. And so again, it's the woman who's at fault. She steals his money, she cheats at cards, with her loot, with her fruit, with her wine, she leads this man to a point of self-degradation. And she humiliates the man. And so we can condemn the woman for being she's Eve's sister after all. And it all goes back to Eve, and Eve is responsible for this whole miserable kind of situation in the 17th century. This again is the painter Honthorst, and the subject matter is merrymaking. And again, it involves that strong use of that internal light. There's a candle back there that tries to illuminate this interesting dark eating place, a place of eating and drinking. The woman is feeding the man. I think the old woman in the back possibly is the agent between the man and the young woman. Very frequently, there's an older woman that's acting as the procurer of the woman for the man. But this is a very common theme in 17th century Dutch painting, this theme of merrymaking. And maybe some of you have some feeling about why this is so important. It's certainly one can vicariously participate in this experience. I don't think we're condemning anybody. I don't know that we're necessarily in this painting making any comment about the woman. But at any rate, it's a scene in which men and women mutually come together to eat and drink and to make love. This is called the Merry Flea Hunt. And I cannot think of any reason why this is a legitimate subject matter for painting. Perhaps the woman is a harlot. Perhaps the old woman is her mother, but maybe the old woman is her agent. And they're looking for this flea. Obviously, it's an excuse to present a kind of voyeuristic experience for the viewer. We'll assume that the viewer is a man. We know that the artist is a man. We assume that the client for the painting is a man, and maybe it's for his own private entertainment. But the subject matter I've seen in a number of paintings done by a number of very important, very prominent kinds of artists. I don't remember that Rembrandt ever did a painting like this. But it's a portrait of ordinary life, and maybe we're supposed to say ho-hum about that, but it's difficult to. Well, this is the woman I want to focus on. This is Judy Lester. And the name of the painting is The Proposition. The subject matter is not that different from all the paintings around Judy Lester. This relationship of the man offering money to the woman. But this one is quite different. And Judy Lester looks at this subject from the point of view of the woman, from the point of view of the victim. The woman is painted with great dignity, and great sensitivity. I mean, she really is a very strong, beautiful form, a beautiful woman. She's engaged in a domestic task. She's sewing. I think down on the bottom, you can see those little red marks. That indicates a foot warmer, and I'd like to read a little paragraph about a foot warmer in a moment. But this man with the fur cap on comes and puts his hand on her shoulder, and he offers her money, and he wants her to come with him. And I think we can assume that she says no, that there's kind of an embarrassed silence as she rejects this man, as she goes about her duty, as she focuses on her task. And no matter how hard the man tries, she will ignore him. And I think this man has put this woman into a very difficult position. I'm sure she doesn't want to be cruel to this man, but she has to be, because this is an inappropriate gesture. So again, remember that hundreds and hundreds of painters are making hundreds and hundreds of paintings about a kind of about what we would call an immoral lifestyle, about the great frequency of brothels in the cities of Holland in the 17th century, about the proliferation of places of merrymaking. And maybe this is either real, maybe this is an accurate reflection of the lifestyle of that century, or maybe it's fiction, maybe it's a vicarious way to participate in this lifestyle. Nevertheless, this is what artists were talking about, and again, I think we have to underline the fact that this is what male artists are talking about. This is what male artists like to think about, and it's what male clients like to buy. And Judy Lester is unique, and all the women that are appearing, as art historians are going back and going through the dark corners of the museums and looking back into the records and discovering these people, they all seem to have a very strong, unique point of view. Not all of them. There are a lot of women who are more ordinary, and they went along with the status quo and painted the same kinds of things men did. But this painting really stands out. Let's see, let me read a statement about the foot warmer that I think helps us a bit. It's cold in that room, and I can understand why it wouldn't be much fun to, to get off that foot warmer and to take off all of those nice warm clothes and to get involved with this man. The snow is flying. It's Minnesota. It's 37 below. We're up at Thor Nordwall's cabin. Although that kind of stuff doesn't go on up there. Let's see. This is from a book called An Emblem Book in 1614, written by a man named Vischers. And the title of this little item is called A Favorite of Women. A foot warmer with fire in it is a beloved jewel with our Dutch women, especially when snowflakes fall and the hail and the frost chase leaves from the trees. The man who wants to win attention in the second place with women, first place goes to the foot warmer, has to push himself to serve her with sweet, funny small talk, avoiding all clumsiness and rudeness, without reprimanding her chatter and never making fun of her frilly clothes. But if he praises what she does and how she looks, then he will be praised in her company as a perfect gentleman. But that's not going to happen here, because this is a very sensitive woman who's being victimized by a very coarse man. I have a detail of this. I really admire that face of this woman. I can identify with the kind of agony that she's going through. I can hear her silence. I can understand the tension. It's a very painful kind of painting. And I think Judy Lester should be commended for taking this very unique, very special point of view, in which she brings the perspective of herself. I don't know if that this ever happened to her, but somehow she had sense enough not to go along with commercially successful paintings. And I don't know if anybody would have wanted to buy this painting, because it's not about a wench. It's about a very dignified person who has a great deal of humanity. Let's see, her paint, just a little note about the painting style. Again, look at the shirt. Look at that very bold, vigorous brush stroke. or the way Judy Lester describes the lap, this bravura brushstroke, this very forceful kind of brushstroke, is characteristic of the style of Franz Hals. And Rembrandt sometimes had that sort of direct, aggressive attack, made that same kind of aggressive attack on the canvas. And that style was transmitted to the United States, the Ashcan School, some of you might know about, in the 1900s, were used Franz Hals and some of these kinds of painters as their models. Robert Henrein, George Bellows, and John Sloan cultivated that kind of aggressive, adventurous brushstroke. And it gives you a sense of the presence of the artist. You get the feeling just through the brushstroke that he's there or she's there looking at the model. You can hear the brush drag across the canvas. That kind of painting gives you a sense of immediacy, a sense of your being there, a sense of your being a participant with this event. And a much more fine, smooth kind of technique renders the painting much more anonymous, much more artificial. So you don't get a sense of the realism. I'll just go back 1 second to look at the whole thing again. I was trying to figure out exactly why she pushed the event over to the side. There's that blank space behind the chair. Maybe if she'd centered the scene, it wouldn't have been quite as dramatic as it is. The man almost falls out of the painting. And you sort of focus on the space between the light and the man and the woman over there asymmetrically on the side, and you play that against the whole rest of the painting. And I think it helps to isolate the woman and her discomfort. That's the main point of this session, is to think about that one painting called The Proposition. This also is Judy Lester. I think here she's going along with the fashion in 17th century Dutch painting. This is called The Merrymakers. I have no idea if this is a couple, but the woman is certainly plying the man with wine, and he's plying her with music. And I can't say for sure that this is taking place in a brothel. But even in Jan Vermeer's paintings, one gets the sense that this very elegant painter was painting life inside a brothel, because there are paintings on the wall that subtly point towards the whole idea of the procurus or the proposition. But this painting was believed to have been by Franz Hals, and it was cleaned in this century, and her initials appeared, and the former owner sued the cleaner because as a Lester painting it was worth much less than as a Hals painting. She's a good designer, a good composer. She knows how to tell a story. There's a lot of drama in the way she puts these parts together. There's subtle nuances of the human personality, a human emotion being expressed. I like this woman's sort of strange look at this man, and the man looks like he's about to drift off into Never Never Land. The brush very vigorously describes those valleys and hills in the man's trousers. She was very skillful and very aggressive in the way she drew and painted. I might make one point of comment about Calvinism again. And I'm sure many of you are aware of the general tradition in the Dutch Reformed Church. It reacted strongly against Italy and against the Church of Rome. There was a strong movement away from traditional religious subject matter. There was a movement towards a celebration of ordinary life, and this then became the only legitimate form of painting. In some cases, ordinary life was seen as a manifestation of the handiwork of God. God the Creator. And that was a way of, I think, legitimizing paintings about fruits and flowers and animals and landscapes. But then it's easy to simply forget that and to move into very secular kinds of paintings. And I think in this case, we'd have to call this a secular painting. Maybe Judy Lester is trying to moralize in this painting. Maybe she's thinking of art in its utilitarian sense, its practical sense, its way of telling stories or preaching sermons or teaching lessons. But I think, I'm not sure that that's exactly what her point of view is. I think she simply is letting us see a piece of secular life. This is her signature, and Lester means lodestar, and she made this diagram with which she signed all of her paintings, which is a kind of pun on her own name. That painting was signed in 1630, and it's that discovery that led to the attribution of this work to Judy and not to Franz Hals. So I have just two more paintings. Now I'd like to just quickly look at a couple of other Dutch women. This is the gallant suitor, and I have no way of suggesting that this is in the same category as the Procurus or some of the paintings that we've been seeing. But there was a lot of interest in this relationship of men and women, this whole tradition of courtship, and all of the rituals involved in that kind of behavior. That was the gallant suitor. This is another kind of suitor, but I think the presence of the lute player in the background, kind of sinister figure way in the back, suggests that this indeed might be a portrait of a brothel. I think the little dog traditionally is named Fido. Fido means fidelity. Fidelity means faithfulness. And I think in this case, the dog would represent unfaithfulness. Usually that dog is present in these kinds of relationships. Well, again, the main point of this presentation is to suggest through that one painting the very unique perspective of Judy Lester in that one painting. But let's look at just three more paintings by some other Dutch women. Maria Oosterwijk was a flower painter. One more thing about Judy Lester. This is a common problem among women artists. Judy Lester married another painter. They had three children, and she was not able to reconcile an art career with family life. And this is an all too common pattern among women artists. We will be seeing a woman in a moment who had 10 children and somehow remained immensely productive. I think it's partly because she was very successful and she could afford to hire a lot of help. But this woman, her father was a pastor. He recognized her talent at a very early age. He got her apprenticed to the guild, and she became internationally famous. And you'll find her work in the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna. Bobby and I were visiting there, and we saw this painting of the flowers, and we got too close, and the electronic sensor set off an alarm system, and the guards came rushing over and screaming at us in German. We didn't know what we had done wrong. But these Dutch painters give us a remarkable scientific, a remarkable scientific record of their observation of nature, an observation that was very intense, very painstaking, and very careful. And a lot of these women were engaged in this kind of subject matter. And I think, again, it's typical of a Calvinist society, which prohibits images traditionally associated with the biblical texts. Rembrandt breaks away from that. But again, this is part of the mark of the handiwork of God, and I think that was the intention. This is a new altar painting. Instead of the Madonna and Child or the crucifixion, this is the mark of God himself. So there is a great deal of scientific investigation that goes on in this detailed exploration of the flowers. But if we look at some of the details, the paintings also become stories about the cycle of life, stories about birth, maturity, and death. And so the paintings remind us of the fleeting, transitory quality of life itself. Let's look at some of the details. There are these, there's a butterfly. And down in the bottom there, I think there's a little spider. Well, here's a butterfly down in this corner. The detail doesn't quite show it, but if you can see the real painting, you see worms crawling around, you see flies, you see insects chewing on leaves and stems, and you know that these plants will fade. You also know how long a plant lasts. Let's see, there's moths and butterflies, perhaps the idea of lay up treasures in heaven that moths do not corrupt. We talked close to some of those texts in the Bible study this morning. I think that's part of the thinking of some of these paintings of flower pieces, that we do become aware of the transient quality of this beauty, of this color, and how it will disappear and fade very quickly. Rachel Roisch is another one of these painters who was internationally very successful. We're getting out of the 17th century and way into the 18th century. She had an international reputation. Her work was in demand. I don't think she's as prominent in the 20th century as she was in the 18th century, but she wasn't completely unknown. This is her main main subject matter was the floral piece. Again, she had 10 children. She came from a distinguished family. Her mother's father was an architect, a well-known architect, a very prominent figure. Her father was a professor of anatomy in the university. She was surrounded by a family life of learning and education in response to Western civilization. And her family promoted her art education. I don't know if any of you have gotten close to one of these paintings, but I find it to be a very important experience to get close and to see how much a person can find in one little flower. It means sitting and staring. It means contemplation for long periods of time. It means really digging. Each little flower becomes a long novel, like War and Peace. It can take you hours to read that one little flower. And I marvel at the ability of a person to sustain his or her interest in an object or a thing or a phenomena for that amount of time. I find watching these carpenters around here as they carefully fit these logs together and make these joints. I find the kind of care that goes into that, I would call that a religious experience. It's an experience of intense involvement. And you get some of that experience in Rachel Roisch's flower pieces. Again, it's a wonderful example of scientific observation, but there also is this other theme of the cycle of life and the transitory quality of life. See, there's this beautiful insect which is up here. Maybe I don't have to point these things out. There's this worm, there's that wonderful creature down at the bottom, like a creature from science fiction, but it isn't science fiction, it's for real. I think of some wonderful Chinese paintings I've seen on the grasshopper theme. And it's there in Egyptian art. It's an ancient insect. And it's exciting. I don't know why it's exciting, but it's exciting to see it pictured thousands of years ago. And one, this is the last painting I'm going to show. This is a floral piece with fruit, insects, and a bird nest down on the bottom there. Another one with beetles. There's a little lizard down on the bottom. The bird's nest. Images of grapes and fruit. Many of you have traveled in Europe and you know these huge paintings of the marketplace of fruit and fish and vegetables and meat and birds and all this sumptuous richness of the creation. Once in a while, there are objects in here which we know are very expensive. An orange, for example, was a priceless fruit. An orange came from far away, and the artist often peeled it and left it sitting there in the still life to rot, and that would be a sign of affluence, that you could afford to buy an orange and let it just sit there and die because it was such a rare fruit. So part of these kinds of paintings, I think, are indications of a wealthy people who wanted to display their wealth, who wanted to affirm their wealth by surrounding themselves with this evidence of the material world. So I think it operates on that level. It also operates, as I say, as an altar painting, as a religious painting, as evidence of God's love. But I think more often than not, it would be a mark of affluence, of our need to surround ourselves with things. But then there's also that theme of the reminder of death, the reminder of the transitoriness and the fleeting beauty of life. It's fun to look at each individual grape and find all of the textures and forms and the moisture and the shiny and the matte qualities. Just the intense kind of observation that goes on. Look at the little flies. It was the fly in a painting in Vienna that got me so close to the painting and almost got us shot by the guards. If you go to Vienna, be very careful. The guards are so aggressive. And when you walk around, you hear these sensors clicking. You know you're being watched. It's really strange because in the back rooms, in the back halls, there are all these really priceless, wonderful Flemish paintings, and they're largely unattended because somebody thinks they're not as important as the paintings in the main gallery. It was interesting to be in the Rijksmuseum where Rembrandt's Nightwatch was slashed by an insane person. And you would think that that museum would be very alert. But I noticed the guards there were really indifferent. I remember one guard that I'm sure was intoxicated. I can't imagine that museum allowing that to happen. The guards in the Louvre Museum were absolutely indifferent. But if you go to Vienna, you better be very good, or you'll get slapped. I think this is my last detail. I think I'll just quit. I think I've made my point. And I will give you one more sneak preview of coming attractions. And I think the topic tomorrow of Susanna and the Elders, which I talked about last week, is a really provocative topic. Period. But I don't want to run away if somebody would like to explain what it means to be a painter in a Calvinist world. How many minutes do we have here? See, it's 7:20. We could take a couple minutes if anybody would like to. Yes?
I was wondering if you were able to, some of the distinctions you were making yesterday about male and female perspective, is that really kind of non-existent in her, these women's work? Or, I mean, can you draw our attention to any of those distinctions or?
No, I think, I would say in her style and in her technique and in the way she relates to the tradition, Judith Lester isn't any different from the men, except for the fact that she treats women very specially from her own perspective on the subject. I don't know exactly how to relate that to this notion of eros or logos that I was talking about last night. In 2 days I'll talk about some two artists that I think we can make that distinction. There are a lot of 20th century artists, of women artists, who are really involved in, more involved in life processes and biological themes, or even in their techniques or procedures. Women who work with nature and with the landscape, sculptors who work with living materials. But for a long time, she was thought of as, her work was attributed to Frans Hals, so I can't make that distinction. I was thinking about that today, wondering what did yesterday have to do with today? Yesterday was something I had to get off my chest. I was just trying to pull all these things together that have been floating around during the past week. Is there a church historian here who can make a comment about Calvinism? I don't want to smear Mr. Calvin. Well, maybe we should go outside and get ready for Vespers.
Thank you.